This week's episode of Pop Story and Podcast brought to you by coffee.
It's good coffee. French press.
It's a French press Hawaiian blend.
Ooh.
The Popstorian Podcast with Chris and Ben.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange and market.
A date which will live in infamy.
I'm repeating, we're not in Kansas anymore.
What are you supposed to do when you see the flash?
Duck and cover.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Might have gotten away with it, too. If it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The evil of the thriller.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you.
Great power comes great responsibility.
This is the Pop Story and Podcast, sponsored by coffee.
I'm Chris.
I'm Ben. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Ben. Welcome to Pop Story and Podcast.
Yes, indeed.
So what is our movie today?
Well, today we're continuing our series Westerns by the Decade. If you've been enjoying the series so far, be sure to give us a subscribe. You can follow us on the social medias. We're on a lot of them right now.
We're on Twitters. We're on the Facebooks and Instagram.
Yes. And Stitcher, well, I guess it's not really social media, is it?
They do carry our podcast, though.
They do carry our podcast. YouTube.
We're on YouTube,
all kinds
too.
Of places.
So just basically Google us, Pop Story, and we'll pop up.
Popstorian.com. We have an email address.
We do.
Popstorian.
The upshot of all this, contact us. We need some input.
If you're one of our two listeners, please reach out.
It's up to three now.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, it went down to two for a while.
Oh, well, I hadn't checked it in a couple weeks. So. But I'm very encouraged by our growth.
Yeah.
It's healthy. It's good.
I'm very pleased. I'm pleased as punch. Okay. So this week, we're continuing our series, Westerns by the Decade.
With Destry Rides Again.
Yes, our film for the 1930s. Is on the very, very tail end of the 1930s.
It's released in, what, December? So this is literally, like, yes. The last Western that we possibly
could have
chosen. I
believe December 29th. So we're about 2 days,
from
two
the
or
40s,
three days from
the 1940s.
But
I was doing research on this and thinking about this. I'm like, Ben, this is the best choice you could have made. Because
you think so?
I do. Because this is a great pivot point from the 30s to the 40s. Because 39 is 10 years after the start of the Great Depression. And then in December 39, there's only a few months after the war in Europe starts. So World War II has already started by this point.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Depression is winding down to the United States. And so we're going to kind of touch on both a little bit here.
Right.
So it's a great pivot point. Thank you, Ben, for choosing it.
I mean, we could have done... We were very, very close... Between this movie and Stagecoach.
Which would have probably had the same.
Which would have had a similar...
similar thing.
But I don't know that I had ever seen this movie before. I thought it was... Regular listeners will know that I have encountered many movies without actually watching them all the way through. Thanks to Turner Classic Movies. And just the TV being on in the house that I grew up in.
Yeah.
But I haven't always seen them all the way through. And I realized... I thought that Destry was one of those films... But I realized I don't think I've ever actually seen it before.
I knew I'd seen it all the way through,
uh-huh.
But it had been a very long time since I watched this film. So it was good to rewatch it.
It was a good rewatch, and I'd watched Stagecoach more recently. So
yeah.
Maybe if we do another pass, we'll tackle Stagecoach. But...
That alternate universe we have to.
Right.
We have to do this all over again.
It's the Pop Story and Podcast with Briss and... Kryn,
which I'm sure
our alternate universe
that could be a thing
identities.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good. Anyway,
oh man, should we talk about the movie?
Yeah, give us a plot.
So the plot of this movie is basically about a rough and tumble western town, kind of your archetypical Western town filled with gunslingers. There's not a lot of law and order. There's a powerful man who's kind of in control. And they, in order to maintain their power, they kill a sheriff, the town sheriff, who stands up to them and kind of cover it up and pretend like nothing happened. With the aid of a saloon singer who's becomes very pivotal to the plot. I don't know, I'm doing a bad job of describing this plot.
It's okay, that's par for the course. I'm just
true.
We're just true. We try to get through the plot.
We always try to get through the summary, but we get very derailed.
I thought maybe
so. If you do it,
you would get through it better. So it's okay.
Oh man. So there's the saloon singer becomes a pivotal character as well, but in the absence of the sheriff, the town drunk is made sort of a puppet sheriff. And they summon, the puppet sheriff summons Destry Jr.
Yes. That's his deputy.
To come be his deputy and to help clean up the town, because Destry Sr. was kind of a awesome legendary
sheriff,
gunfighter type sheriff who was reputed for cleaning up all these towns that were desiccated by crime and lawlessness. Destry comes to town, and Destry Jr., I should say, comes to town, and they find that he's somewhat demure? Is that the word I'm looking for?
I think that would work.
He's not exactly effeminate, but
he doesn't
carry
guns.
A gun, which is sort of the key.
Well, he does carry guns, but they're in his suitcase. He doesn't actually wear them to town.
Right. So. Which is something I definitely want to talk about.
Yes.
As far as like themes and
that's what I want to talk about too.
But yes, he comes to town and he immediately proves that he wants to use his brain rather than brute force to kind of change the situation. And he slowly develops a plan to overthrow the wicked powers that be and restore order to the town. Do we want to go into like a full synopsis and talk about how it ends and all that? Or
I think that'll do us for right now. I think that's a good place to start.
If you haven't seen the film, you should watch it before you listen to the rest of the podcast, because we will probably discuss spoilers.
Yeah. But I do want to talk about is this is our first comedy. It's the first time we've seen a Western
comedy,
like coupled with another genre.
Yeah.
And I have a theory about this film that I'm not sure is true, because I haven't actually read a whole lot about what people are saying about this film. Because it's usually the book that I've read about it is that this is a comedy kind of based off of Max Brand's book. But they call it a spoof or parody, but it's not as spoofish as some of the later films like Young Frankenstein or Casino Royale will be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a prototype of those ideas.
Yeah, and it very much so. We should mention you've actually read.
So I read Max Brand's book.
Destry Rides Again.
In preparation. It's called Destry Rides Again.
Which is not a sequel.
It's not a sequel. It is the only thing that the movie and the book share, apparently.
Right.
Because even the town's names are different.
When did the book come out?
1930. So in the movie, the town's name is Bottleneck. I don't think you mentioned that. But in the book, it's called Wham.
Wham?
Wham. Wham.
Wow. What a great name for a town.
It is called Wham. But in the book, the character Destry is a very much rough and tumble. It's almost like they're describing Destry's father in the movie.
Right.
And he's the best with his fists, the guns, the knives. He's never been beaten. He's a bully. And he's in the book, he's actually framed for robbery. And he's so arrogant that he doesn't even think that they're going to convict him when he's in the court. He turns away like two or three different lawyers that the judge kind of suggests to him. Uh-huh. But they do convict him, and the jury, who's not made up of not really nice people anyway, but he does say he's going to get his revenge on the jury.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes off to prison. He's sentenced to 10 years and then comes back at 6 and pretends like he's a broken man and he doesn't carry a gun. And,
mm-hmm.
and but it's all a ploy for that one chapter because he turns out that he does carry guns. And he'll continue on his rampage until the towards the, like it's the last quarter of the book where he realizes he's been kind of had by a bigger villain who's actually the one who framed him for the mm-hmm. robbery. And in the end of the book, he is beaten by this villain. He is by both fists and gunfights because they do have a duel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if he's wounded or if the gun is just shot out of his hand in classic Western style.
Right.
But he's beaten with the guns, and then they have a fistfight / wrestling match, and he is beaten then again.
Mm.
And when he does end up shooting the bad guy, but it's kind of a lucky shot. He's like way up on the hill, and
mm-hmm.
he fires from the hip, and he manages to kill the bad guy. And he realizes that he is not as awesome as he thought he was in the beginning of the film, or the book, rather. And he ends up giving up the guns. He kind of throws him to the way of the gun off to the side and marries his lady love and lives happily ever after.
So it's kind of a redemption story in a way.
Very much so.
He starts off as kind of a ruffian and learns the error of his ways.
Yeah. And then 2 years later, they actually make a film called Destry Rides Again,
right.
starring Tom Mix.
Yeah.
And this film apparently is a lot closer to the book than the 1939, where he does use guns and he does clean up the town. And
I haven't seen it.
I have not seen it either, but
do you remember what studio it is?
I don't.
Let me look that up real quick. I'm just curious.
But this kind of in the line of why I'm going to say that this 1939 film is a spoof. It's because Tom Mix apparently never went under any other character name but Tom. So in the book, I failed to mention, the character's name is Harry Destry, or Harrison Destry, not Tom Destry. And so Tom Mix kind of changes the name of the character, and then that's taken up in the 1939. Jimmy Stewart
right.
is called Tom Destry, or the son of Tom Destry.
Right.
And so
it's an interesting evolution.
It is, and kind of that comedy aspect of it.
Right.
It's like the same genre as Young Frankenstein, where you're mm-hmm. a younger generation, but you kind of end up doing the same thing as your forebears did, but in a very comedic way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my theory, that this film was designed as a spoof, as a parody.
Yeah.
Of the Western genre.
Nerdwriter, who's a YouTuber, are you familiar with any of his?
Mm-mm.
You may have seen some of his videos. He did a video on genre. I think he was talking about superhero genre.
I think you've shown me this video.
But he has this kind of theory that there's like the archetypical aspects of genre. So with a Western, it might be a film like Stagecoach, where it's like it meets all the criteria, it checks all the boxes for what a Western is.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of it lives up to the standard and kind of like maximizes what it can be. And then there's like the deconstruction of a genre. So something like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where it's very like, it's untraditional. The heroes are kind of like anti-heroes. They're not all they're cracked up to be. And then there's the parody, which would be, he uses the example of Blazing Saddles, of
yeah.
being like, it's in the genre, but it's making fun of the genre at mm-hmm. the same time. So he talks about those different stages of, and then also like, I think there's one other, Reinvention or something like that.
Which this one might be closer to a reinvention because it's not as silly as Blazing Saddles would be.
Yeah, I'm massacring his analysis, but what's interesting to me is that he talks about it as if it happens kind of linearly.
Mm-hmm.
So big picture, like you would say the 1930s, 40s, 50s, you have these kind of like archetypical Westerns. And then in the 60s, you have the deconstruction. And then in the 70s and 80s, you have some Western parodies, and then you have a reinvention period with Clint Eastwood's Westerns in the 90s and Lonesome Dove and all that.
I don't know
but
if I would.
I don't think
it is as linear as he is.
That's what I'm
yeah.
saying, because this film, that's kind of my point, is I don't think it's linear at all.
Yeah.
I feel like it was being spoofed almost as soon as it was invented.
Yeah, if you go back and watch Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin.
Right, or, yeah, any of those.
Or any of those guys.
Mickey Mouse cartoons.
Laurel and Hardy.
Right.
You're going to see this spoofed way before this, before his analysis would claim. And maybe he is not linear. Maybe he's thinking cyclical.
Right. Or maybe I'm... Yeah, that could be it. Maybe I'm misinterpreting his analysis too, but I don't know. If you haven't checked out the Nerd Writer's video on genre, you should do it. You can find it on his channel.
Okay.
Yeah, it is. I didn't expect it to be a spoof or a comedy. It's not really what I was looking for. And I did some research before I watched the film, and I was like, huh, George Marshall, he directed a lot of comedy.
You know, I try to look up George Marshall, trying to figure out kind of some of his personal life and personal beliefs. You really can't. I couldn't find a
biography of him.
He's done like over 400 movies, but I haven't found a biography.
Some of them are pretty significant titles too.
He is one of three main directors from How the West Was Won. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that movie.
Mm-hmm. I've never seen it.
The other two are amazing directors. John Ford and Hathaway, Henry Hathaway, which both have done amazing westerns in their own rights. Mm-hmm. So he's a big name.
His sequence is one of the most well-regarded from that film, I think, too. So, yeah, he's a very significant name, very significant director. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people, well, I mean, he started way back in the silent era, directing silent shorts for comedy stars like Laurel and Hardy, and went all the way up to the late 60s, I think it was his last directing gig for television. So
it's
a massive span of a director. Joe Pasternak is the producer, also something of a legendary producer, produced a lot of titles. Hal Moore is the cinematographer. Hal Moore actually shoots, most famous for shooting The First Talkie, the jazz singer.
Oh, wow.
So that's a link.
Yeah. There. I wanted to ask you, did you read anything about the writers of this?
No, I didn't dig up anything. One of them is a woman.
Okay.
Which is...
I guess somewhat unusual for the time.
Well, one of the two major roles that women have always kind of played in the motion picture industry more than others are the writer and the editor. Writing and editing were kind of considered acceptable positions for a woman to take in the very male-dominated world of motion picture making.
Huh.
Even though, of course, there were female filmmakers very early.
Yeah.
But dominantly, there was a lot more women in the writing and the editing fields. I guess because they were somehow thought of as less important in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, writers were very, very put upon. It isn't until, I think, 1935 that the writers actually get organized into a union. So up to that point, they were pretty much just being... You know,
like, go do this.
Yeah, these large studios were just coming in and making them do it. And if you wouldn't do it, if you wouldn't play ball, there was always somebody else to do it. So it wasn't thought of as very important the way that you or I might think of a writer of a movie as being very key or essential to the development of the story.
Yeah.
It really wasn't thought of that way then. It was just kind of like, here's somebody to lay the blueprints, and then the director will throw it all out and... Well, make it a movie.
The reason I asked particularly about the writing is because when we watched the film, we noticed a very strong anti-gun theme.
Mm-hmm.
I think you wanted to talk about this, too.
Yeah, for sure.
And
it's a very strong script.
Yeah.
It flows very well, and the pacing is fantastic. The dialogue is great.
I tried to look up... The reason I was looking up George Marshall so closely is to see, well, is it him that's putting this into the film, this anti-gun theme? Or is it Pasternak himself? And I meant to look up the writers, but I didn't get a chance to do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the origin story is with that.
Well, I did do some contextual research on that. And there's a couple of possibilities. One is that this is right before the United States enters the war. The United States will enter the war in 42.
So there's kind of like December, an anti-war...
December 41, but about 42. And there's like isolationists, there's pacifists. So there's kind of that area of things. But also there is an anti-gun debate going on in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
During the New Deal, there are certain anti-gun laws being put into place, like the National Firearms Act in 34. There's another one in 38. And these are kind of hoping to control gun violence, like gangsterland violence. You heard of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Right.
So they're hoping to kind of control things a little bit. And then in 1939, there was actually a Supreme Court decision on it called the United States versus Miller. And the upshot is that the United States does have the right to limit what firearms you can purchase. Like sawed-off shotguns are now illegal, and that's part of that. Gotcha. Law is from the 30s. So, because there was a lot of gun violence with the gangs.
Yeah, it's interesting. You think about that as being more of a modern problem, but
it goes back to the 1930s.
Quite far.
Yeah.
Even predating things like assault rifles and all that.
Well, in the 30s, you might have heard of something called the Tommy gun.
Right.
Which was a machine gun. It was a submachine gun. It was developed by a fellow by the name of Thompson, who wanted it to use it for World War I.
Mm-hmm.
But his development took too long, and the war ended before he could actually get it to the Allies. So it ends up going to the private sector. So police forces buy it up, and militaries buy it up, but also private citizens buy them because there's no gun laws.
Uh-huh.
So now you have mobsters with Tommy guns. And
that all ties back into Prohibition.
Back in the 20s.
Because a lot of crime rises out of that.
But even with the recall of Prohibition, there's still the organized crime. Mm-hmm. And they're still using these weapons.
Because the infrastructure was kind of in place by that point, as far as the criminal activity goes.
Yeah, and I mean, you make booze legal again, okay, well, we're going to kind of go to something else. Gambling becomes a big one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, very big.
And you got to protect your turf.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think this is ultimately a pacifist or an anti-war film, or really even anti-gun in the end.
Yeah, well, I didn't think it would be anti-war because Marlena Dietrich does eventually go become a USO entertainer, yes, and Jimmy Stewart actually goes into the Air Corps.
Pro, almost nationalistic.
Yeah, and George Marshall and Patrick, neither one of them are really anti-war either.
Right.
So I thought, well, maybe it's anti-gun, or kind of at least going from what's popular in the culture at that time or what's in the news.
Right.
Kind of putting that, making it more relevant at that day.
Yeah. It's interesting because in the end, that's what he has to resort to. And it's kind of like one of the main themes of action film in general, not just Westerns, is this kind of a man's got to do what a man's got to do kind of idea that, you know, when the chips are down, force has to come into play.
And you see that in the film.
And you see that very strongly in the film.
Yeah.
So when his back is up against a wall, he has to resort to violence to a certain degree. But at the same time, what I like about the film is that it does present that argument that violence is necessary sometimes to confront evil.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a cost associated with that violence.
Using violence.
So when Marlena Dietrich's character, his whole reason for not using guns is that his father was shot in the back because he was carrying a gun, is the thought,
yeah.
And Marlena Dietrich's character kind of sacrifices herself to save him, and she gets shot in the back.
And also his best friend, not to spoil the movie for everyone, but
right,
these three characters are all shot in the back.
Right.
From gun violence.
But I attach significance to Marlena Dietrich's character, Frenchie. Mm-hmm. Frenchie's death. Specifically because of that imagery that she's shot in the back, the same way his father died. But also, she dies after he takes up the gun.
It's almost his fault.
Right. Well, he takes a stand, but somebody still has to pay the price for it.
Yeah.
In a way.
But I think
the message of the film is that the price has to be paid, but it's a fair price because the evil has to be defeated.
Well, I'm not sure if I completely agree with that analysis, because in the end of the film, he actually continues not to carry a gun.
That's true.
The last scene, he's walking down the street, and he's making his rounds as sheriff of the town.
Whittling napkin rings.
Yeah, as he does. And he still doesn't carry a firearm at that point. So, I don't know, maybe there's a balance struck at the end of the film where there's a time and place for it, but most of the time you don't need to carry it.
Yeah, I think that was the point all along. It's just I feel like they were trying to make the point that when it is needed, there's still a cost associated.
Yeah.
Which I think is one of my favorite aspects of one of the things that I got out of the film. Maybe this is all just like my imagination, you know, what's the term? Like projecting my opinion onto
a film.
Rather than extrapolating out of the film what's there. But nevertheless, I felt that was something that was quite deep and profound as far as dealing with violence in film and analysis of it.
Yeah, because it's not making fun of gun violence in the film. Even though it's a comedy, it's not making fun of it at all.
No, or making light of it. No. It treats it very seriously.
It does, yeah.
Which is not always the case in...
In action films.
In action films or westerns.
That's true. So, what else did you have about the film itself?
Yeah, like I said, I love the script and the structure of it. It's got a great pace to it. The supporting cast is phenomenal.
I know you mentioned Billy Gilbert a couple times, and he is fantastic.
I love Brian Donlevy as the kind of villain of the piece.
He is actually a big star at this time.
Yeah, he's in a lot of films.
He's in a lot of films. He's, I think, main character in a film like Wake Island, which is a wartime film. He does a lot of westerns, including Beaujeste the same year. But he also did The Dalton's Ride again, I think. I think he was in that film. So yeah, he's actually a pretty big name in this film.
I love his approach to the role and the interplay between him and Dietrich is very strong. I love Charles Winogur as Wash, who has a great tick with tucking in and untucking his shirt as kind of like
that's
a nervous...
That's a great gag in the film.
I love things like that with actors' performances when they can create like a physical something like that for a character.
And that is something in this film that it is a very physical comedy. It's not always a lot of sight or word gags, but there's a lot of visuals in it. Like, what's his name? Misha R. Losing his pants and he can't like hold on to his pants.
Let's talk about that. He's a great character. He's supposed to be Russian?
I think he actually is Russian, and I think the character's supposed to be Russian as well.
It's a little bit ethnically ambiguous, the way it's presented. I wasn't quite sure for most of the film. I didn't realize till the end.
He actually says his whole name.
When he says his whole name.
It's a very Russian name.
I think he said it perhaps earlier, but... Yeah, he's an interesting character. His wife calls him by her ex-husband's name. I didn't catch. Did you catch what happened to her ex-husband? Did he die or was?
I don't think they actually make explicitly say what happens to him. Okay. Like he either leaves her or if he actually dies or not.
Right. I wasn't entirely clear on that. That seemed vague to me.
They were very ambiguous about that.
Didn't matter. But he kind of stands in this guy's shadow, and he's in love with Frenchie.
Yeah. And the great, and of course, great Una Merkel's in this film as well.
Yes.
She's a great character actress.
Yes. Very well-known name.
And of course, the two things that, whenever you read about this movie, the two things that always pop up is, one, it's Marlene Dietrich's comeback, and two, it's the catfight between Una Merkel and Marlene Dietrich.
Which would you like to address first?
since we're already talking about Una Merkel, go ahead and we'll talk about that one.
You want to talk about the fight?
The cat fight.
Yeah, so there's a scene where Una Merkel and Marlene Dietrich kind of go at it in the saloon pretty early in the film.
It is. A lot. When I was reading about it in preparation for watching the film, I was kind of expecting this to be one of the climax scenes. It's not. It's really, really early in the film when you're first introduced to Destry.
Apparently this scene was unchoreographed. They just kind of rolled with it.
They're like, let's do this.
that went at it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how... When I read that, I was like, oh yeah, that's totally plausible uh-huh. that could have happened. But then when I saw the film and saw how long the catfight is...
Yeah.
And they have to hit certain marks in order for...
And there was a couple times I thought I saw... Like, you know how you can see the stunt double change out?
Right.
I thought I saw someone else playing a right. Markle character or
and Martin then, of course, at the end of the fight, Jimmy Stewart's character dumps a bucket of water on them.
Yeah.
So they had to hit a certain position for him to be able to dump that water on them and for the composition to be right. And
yeah.
It just, it feels very, like, so planned.
There might
but the beginning of the fight.
Like, just the way they started off?
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say
before they kind of roll into the center of the room,
might be elements of it that they really did just kind of yeah. do it just to start it off, and then they went back and had other people do
right.
portions of it.
So I feel like it was probably something they attacked, you know, improvisationally, but then built up with stunt doubles and the rest later on.
Yeah, that would be very interesting to kind of. See if they have any records of how they built that scene.
Yeah, that would be.
I would like.
I would love to see a making of book.
I know. I was thinking when I was researching. I was like, why isn't there a book about this movie?
Yeah, I don't understand why there's not more information. But we also didn't have time to dig very deep, as deep as we would like to. So,
yeah.
Yeah, very interesting sequence.
And what did you research more about Marlena Dietrich? Because all I got was that this was her comeback, and before that she was kind of considered box office poison because she had done like 3 films and they were all flops.
I think if I'm not mistaken, she was on the list. There was a popular list at the time that came out, I think in Variety, of 9 actresses who were considered box office poison, and I think she was on the list. Because of her 3 flops that she had. And also there was kind of like a rising tide of anti-German sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
And Marlena Dietrich, of course, comes from that part of the world.
Yeah. She actually is German. I looked at it.
And had worked with some German directors in the silent days. So there was kind of this public sentiment that was leaning against her with those 2 things. But... She makes a very strong comeback by presenting herself as a very patriotic person, and of course she tours with the USO extensively.
But this is even before the USO, really.
Before
America enters the war.
You're correct.
Yeah.
So she kind of created her own persona as a very pro-American, and I think being in a Western, you can't get more American than a Western.
I didn't even think about that. That's true.
Yeah. Really was a step in the right direction for her and her handlers, agents, and the studios and what like. If you want to know more about Marlena Dietrich, there's a great series in the You Must Remember This podcast, which is a podcast about Hollywood history. She does a great series on Marlena Dietrich.
I gotta look that up.
That I recommend.
I've listened to some of her stuff. They're pretty good.
She can go into a lot more detail than I can.
Yeah. Oh, shout outs all the way around.
But I'm reading Donald Dewey's biography of Jimmy Stewart.
Yes.
I have not finished it yet, but apparently this is a very foundational and important time for Jimmy Stewart in terms of solidifying his star power.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of comes to MGM in the mid-30s as a contract player after being on stage in New York and Boston, and he's spotted by a talent scout and kind of whisked away and becomes a contract player. They give him his big break, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which we'll talk about in our 1939 show.
that would be great.
So this is kind of the follow-up to that success and kind of catching the wave of that.
That was the same year.
Mm-hmm.
So
he...
this was a big year for him.
Yeah, very big year for him. Playing opposite Dietrich. A lot of people contend that they were an item during the making of this film.
I think I read Marlena Dietrich had said something
along that. She wrote about it in her autobiography.
Yeah.
Stewart kind of downplayed it in his interviews, saying that it was that they were just dating, and he sort of made it out to not be what all the gossip columnists wrote it out to be, which was, you know, some people wrote that it was a very deep and passionate affair, and Dietrich abandoned him and broke his heart, and it's hard to tell how much is, you know, the
gossip
conflated, because a lot of the studios at this time made a lot of, they generated a lot of interest by setting up couples and putting them out in public together and having them be photographed together and acting as if they were an item when they were really just kind of publicity stunts and staged.
Yeah.
So there's definitely an element of truth to it. I don't think we'll ever know how deeply they were involved, but they are excellent on screen together. Their scenes together are some of the highlight of the picture to me.
Yeah.
They play off each other really well. It's a great scene where he smudges off some of her makeup.
That is a very powerful
tells
scene.
Her to asks her what who would you be if you wiped off all that paint.
And yeah.
It really I don't know, her character is really fascinating. I would be interested to see, I know they remade this film later with a few times. But one in particular with kind of a Frenchy character who was more of the main focus and more of kind of a hybrid of the Marlene Dietrich and the Destry character, where she was more of a gunfighter, right?
She's a saloon girl, but she coming from New Orleans, coming back to see who murdered her father. So,
gotcha.
It's
so
actually,
she's more of the... It's coming into town.
Kind yeah, of she's kind of the Destry character in that sense, but also Marlene Dietrich's character in the other sense.
Right.
It's kind of almost like a hybrid between George Marshall's comedy and the Max Brand novel, from what I understand. I haven't seen the film, actually.
It's interesting because we think of Jimmy Stewart as kind of being the bigger star.
Yeah.
Looking at it in hindsight.
She was the bigger star at the time.
She had the top billing,
yeah,
for sure. And
she was much more known.
Her part is... I don't know. They're both such strong characters, but her part is probably the stronger of the two.
Which I guess makes sense. It's more of her story than
maybe
Jimmy Stewart's story. That's interesting.
I don't know. It's hard to gauge because the plot kind of revolves around Destry.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but
it's the name.
it's the name of the movie.
Yeah.
But her character is quite fascinating. Great performances. Great film.
Yeah. So this film from 1939 is actually, if I do my math right, 16 years after the last film we just did. So Covered Wagon was in 24, 23, something like that.
23.
And then this one was in 39. So a lot has happened in that 16 years period. So in 27, The Jazz Singer is the first talkie. A year later, the first Western talkie, or considered to be the first Western talkie, in Old Arizona in 1928. And then in 1929, the stock market crashes. It's the beginning of the Great Depression. And there is a slight recovery, I think, in 32, which is interesting because Herbert Hoover, who had been the president when the stock market crashes, is voted out because he's basically blamed for the Great Depression. And FDR comes into power at that point. And there's a couple of ebbs and flows, a couple of recoveries and a couple of come downs. But it kind of officially ends by 1939, or at least in the history books. We really don't come really out of it and recover from it until the war.
It's kind of a gradual period of growth that kind of begins in 1939.
Yeah.
Do you feel like Hoover was blamed unfairly?
So whenever, there's of course a political joke, but whenever the economy is good, the president takes the credit, but whenever the economy is bad, everybody blames him.
Right.
And in fact, president has no power whatsoever to really make a strong impact on that.
Right.
I mean, there's things he can do, like today, there's President Trump is doing these tariffs and people blame him for this or that, but I mean, all he's doing is the tariffs. What that's actually causing on the economy, only economists can really tell you.
Yeah, the economics is interesting because it's hard to see the implications of a thing are not always... What's going to happen because of a certain policy is not always obvious.
Yeah, they're
put it that way.
Very interesting economically.
The Depression is a prime example of...
But the Great Depression, I was doing some reading on this, and it is brutal.
Very.
It starts off with the stock market crash, but stock market crash is not end of the world type of thing. What was going on, and remember we talked about the economy a little bit in the 20s, is that the economy was booming. The car industry was like the big thing. But what the car industry ended up doing was it overextended itself. So it would take its profits and like invest it back into the company so they make more cars. Problem is, people don't buy a car every year.
Right.
So if you're producing all of these cars, who's going to buy the cars from you? And on top of this, there isn't a very, there's a wider and wider margin between production and wages for their workers. So standard living goes up, but wages don't go up. You can't, don't have as much buying power. Therefore, that causes, or at least one of the causes for depression as well. And then we also talked about the farming sector, the agriculture sector. That was not doing good in the 20s. And that'll just get worse in the 30s.
Is that because of weather conditions? Or
that's part of it, because there's a huge drought in the 30s.
There's also the Dust Bowl.
The Dust Bowl, and kind of, yeah. But what's happened...
Bad soil management.
After World War One is that, of course, the government's like, farmers, make food for our soldiers and for Europe and everything like that. But then the war ends. And so you have all this food that you can't sell to the army because there's not really an army anymore. You can't sell it to Europe because Europe is busy paying off their debts and they're really poor and they can't, you know, can't buy anything.
They can't afford to import it.
So you have no market for your goods and it becomes cheaper instead of, you can't hire hands to harvest the food. So it becomes cheaper just to leave it in the field and let it rot. And so that causes people late on their loans. And then the banks collapse. And that's that kind of, I think, is probably one of the bigger things, because one of the things of the stock market is people were borrowing to invest in the stock market because the stock market was going so high and so crazy.
Yeah, everybody was
in it. Well, then it comes down, and if you're borrowing money to put in the stock market, you're not going to get that money back, and so people are ruined. Same thing happens. So you know the banks are making those loans. And so you lose the money to pay back the bank suffers, the bank doesn't have the money to recoup. People make runs on the banks because they don't trust the bank, the banks collapse. And at this point, the government doesn't insure any of the any of your investment into those banks, which will change after the Great Depression. So the bank industry is terrible. The auto industry is terrible. Mining and steel and railroads can't really upgrade, and their wages are not that high, and so they have to cut wages, they have to cut jobs, so that's suffering there. Agriculture, people losing their land because they can't pay the banks. The banks are tightening things up, so they foreclose. You remember a movie called The Grapes of Wrath?
Of course.
There's another great movie called It's a Wonderful Life, and that also shows you how the banks kind of suffered on that one, because they're like, $2 left, we're still here. And that kind of shows you on that. But everything just across the board comes down. There's no jobs. Job unemployment rate at its height, like the highest it went, is just below 30%. To put that in context, in the recession 2008, I think the highest it ever got was 10% national unemployment.
Wow.
In Toledo, this is the one example I read about. In Toledo, at one point, unemployment was up to 80%. That's a lot of people out of work.
Wow.
So now suddenly you see all these pictures of the Great Depression. You see in lines for food and in lines for a chance to get a job. And you're just like, wow.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's hard to even imagine. That's interesting that you're saying it's a kind of a perfect storm of factors, really.
It kind of is, yeah.
Not just like one, any one, like people tend to blame the stock market. But
yeah, but the stock market
kind of this myriad of things.
It's almost like a domino. The dominoes start falling, and it wasn't very stable in the 20s. It was just like go, and then in the 30s, reality kind of sets in, and so a lot of I've read people calling it a bubble. So whenever you hear the term bubble in terms of recession, that's kind of what they're talking about. It's like it's unstable and unsustainable.
Yeah, and it seems like you're saying there's also a bubble in the auto industry and in agriculture. So a lot of
well, the agriculture is already depressed at that point,
right?
So gotcha. They have been struggling even in the 20s when everything else was booming. Yeah, because people were going to the cities to get jobs in the factories.
You can because of industrialization.
Yeah.
Also, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but my understanding was a lot of the Heartland, they invested a lot of effort into trying to grow a lot of crops to the point that they were neglecting the fertilization and the maintenance of the land.
And that's what a lot of environmentalist studies, ecology, thank you. That's the study where they think that because they were tearing up the Midlands, that's causing the Dust Bowl. It's right. causing erosion and these dust storms,
right.
Which actually is not good for plants.
Right.
So you're just shooting yourself.
And of course, the South has a long history of, you know, doing these cash crops like cotton and tobacco.
Yeah.
Which that are make a lot of money, but you can't eat. So there's
you can't
not
eat those, and neither one of them are really good for the soil either.
Right. Yeah. True.
They definitely take the nutrients out of the soil.
So yeah, by the time we get to 1939,
things have kind of looked up a little bit with the New Deal. Everybody's looking at FDR because FDR politically is amazing. He kind of steps in and he's like, don't fear. The other thing we have to fear is fear itself. You know, even that line that you kind of very familiar with. And then he has these fireside chats, and he's not necessarily the first president to talk to the American public, but I think he's probably one of the first to really kind of be that stabilizing force.
Mm-hmm.
He reaches down to the people, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting you have this this kind of dominance of mass media during this time.
Yeah.
In a time when you would think that things that we think of as luxuries, media and all this extra stuff, would go to the side. Mm-hmm. But movies
are not. People go to the movies.
And radio and
yeah.
the pulps, all this stuff is huge during the Depression.
The movies, I think, is what? It's like 10 cents to go to the movies. And so the movie industry actually is getting better and bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the point I was going to make in the 1939. By that point, the movies have gotten really good about making these films that appeal to people. And so you see that a lot with, by the end of this is towards the end of the Great Depression. So you have The Wizard of Oz in 1939. Fantasy. Escapism. You have Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, who's this hero that's going to do away with all the bad stuff in Washington, you know.
An ordinary person
hero. Ordinary Americans coming up. You've got Gone with the Wind, where they're on top, and then they get down, and then they come back on top again, and there's all this drama going in between. They're like, hey, that's my life. You know, and they can sympathize with that. And so there's these films that kind of stay around because they appeal to the people and the memories associated with those films.
Hmm.
And there's a lot of films in the 1939 by that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So also another big thing that we could, and we'll definitely talk about the war more
in
the next episode.
Yeah, in the next episode.
But definitely trouble brewing in Europe.
Yes.
At the time this film comes out.
Let's see. Hitler had come to power by 1933. So he'd been in power for a while, and there was a great deal of debate on should we support Hitler or should we not support Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of debate on whether should we our relationship with Russia, because fascism and socialism really don't mesh well. And so there's this kind of thing with there's going to be a war between Russia and Germany. And, of course, there's a racial issue there between the Slavs and the Germans as well. And so the Eastern Front in World War II was brutal, very brutal, and World War I as well. But there was an agreement between Russia and Germany about Poland. And so when Germany actually kind of invades Poland, kind of goes back on the deal, a lot of people are like, let's support Russia on this. And so that's kind of adds on to it. It's not just England that we're looking at supporting in our connection with, you know, it's also Russia that we're also connecting. And you'll notice a lot of Russian characters in the 1930s. Ninochka, 1939 film.
Yeah.
And it kind of paints a not a terrible picture of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, it's interesting. Later on, of course, there would be a lot of anti-communism sentiment in the USA.
There have been a lot previously to this, too. In the 1920s, there's the first Red Scare.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But at this point, in the 1930s, it's not not viewed as such a bad thing.
Right. We're kind of teaming up, almost.
Getting
ready to team up.
It's very interesting.
But in the 1930s, a lot of stuff going on here. Betty Boop is introduced in 1930. 1931, the Star Spangled Banner becomes the official United States national anthem.
Oh, wow.
Empire State Building is
completed. Was there just no prior...
Not really, no. There's several songs that were like patriotic, yeah. You know. But in 1931, it's the official. 1932, Amelia Earhart becomes the first female aviator to successfully fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean.
Yep.
Al Capone is convicted in 1932. 1933, the 21st Amendment is passed, which is doing away with Prohibition. 33, Hitler comes to power. 34, Disney introduces a character by the name of Donald Duck.
Mm-hmm.
Babe Ruth retires from the sport of baseball in 1935. King Edward VIII abdicates the Marian American. The name of Wallace Simpson, 1936, yeah. Jesse Owens will win 4 gold medals in the Berlin Games.
Yes.
In 1936. So this is just kind of a big deal for America as well, because there's a lot of debate on what Hitler is Hitler good or bad for Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Orson Welles' radio adaptation of War of the Worlds is broadcast in 1938, causing a panic. Superman is introduced in 1938 as well. Germany will attack and invade Poland in 1939. And Batman is introduced in 1939.
Yes. Very near and dear to our hearts here at Pop Story and HQ.
At least in my heart, anyway. So, yeah, the 1930s is a lot going on in that time period.
Yeah, this is a deep and rich period, both for Westerns and for pop culture and history in general.
Yeah.
Lots going on, lots to talk about.
Yeah.
I think we're kind of at a good stopping place there.
I think so too. So
next time on Popstorian, we're going to talk about the 1940s.
Have you picked a film for us, Ben?
I have not. So I think we're going to confer and pick one. Do you want to do that now and record our...
We'll pause for right here, and we'll be back. Okay. After much debate and...
time cut.
heart searching, we have come up to a decision.
Yes. It's very tough in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, because there's a lot of important and influential Westerns, but for this round... at least. We're only going to do one for the 40s. And we had to go with a John Ford film. It's My Darling Clementine.
Henry Fonda, 1946.
So you can look forward to that next month. In the meantime, enjoy our weekly mini-sodes that we somehow managed to cobble together. Thank you for listening to the Pop Story and Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe in your favorite podcatcher.
And check us out on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube now.
Yes. Chris does a great job of keeping all that social media updated. There's all kinds of cool stuff on there if you're interested in pop culture and history, articles and memes and good times. So give us a follow on there if you don't already. Thank you, Chris,
for your
work. Great job doing the research on this one. This was a research-heavy one, so... well done. Great job.
We need to tell more jokes on it.
That's my job. You do the work. I'll just tell the jokes.
All right.
There'll be really bad cow jokes, too.
Oh, I have a good cow joke.
What's our cow joke of the week, Chris?
Cow joke. What do you call a cow with a twitch?
Cow with a twitch. I don't know.
Beef jerky.
Well done. If you have a cow joke, please email us popstorian@gmail.com, and we'll be happy to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to the Popstorian podcast. Be sure to subscribe. You can find us online at popstorian.com or on Facebook and Twitter. Tune in next time for more of the history of popular culture.
We also take it on Twitter too. Give us a tweet.
Give us a tweet, direct message. Anything, just reach out to us. We're so lonely.
We're telling each other
they won't let
us
out of the sound booth.
I think you should probably just put a stop to it now.
And that's
put
the
us
end
out
of
our
this.
Misery.
Fade to black. See you next time.